yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roll.
Hello and welcome to the KBO Radio Bike Show. I hope this finds you well and that your days are full of light. My name is Alon Robb and I'm joined by co-host Nedra Deadweiler. Good day, Nedra. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Alon. Good to hear your voice.
It's always great hearing you. I wish you were closer. You're in Atlanta, but you're here in our hearts and your spirit is here. So what's new with you? What's the good word?
Oh, the good word is, it's a good question. It's really, I'm having a great time. Like, my energy is high. Life is good. Enjoying the weather. So,
amen.
Yeah, that's what's new.
May it continue. For me, the height of my cycling existence has been being published in an Iranian cycling journal, a wonderful journal called Kuchma, edited by a fantastic young man who published one of my studies on the history of women cycling in the Middle East. And perhaps in the future we could have him. So I'm sending a warm greeting to the editor in Iran. So we'll connect again around half hour mark, Nedra. So I'll say goodbye for now.
Okay, congratulations on that.
Thank you. Today's show is about leadership and also about urban geography. In the first half of the show, our guest is Karen Frost, longtime activist and the first head of the BTA, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, the bicycle organization that was at the forefront of cycling activism and which is still going strong under a new name, the Street Trust. Our guest in the second half of the show is Neil Davis, an Atlanta-based urban geographer whose work focuses on the intersection of education, public health, transportation, planning, and sustainability. Mr. Davis's work is at the forefront of how these factors impact resilience in underserved communities. We are glad that you, our listeners, are with us today, and we always appreciate hearing from you with comments or suggestions. You could reach us at alonkrobb@gmail.com. Our engineer today is Ty Walker, and the show will be made available for future listening by Josh Hetrick and Chris Smith, archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. Before we get to our first guest, Karen Frost, a few brief news items from the vast bicycle universe. The first items are from Portland. During the last month, the protected bike lane on Southwest Broadway in the heart of downtown Portland was in the news. As reported by Bike Portland, the Portland Bureau of Transportation planned on changing the design of this major downtown bike lane, much of it a protected lane, to a less safe version under pressure from downtown hotel and business owners. The plan was to remove the parking protected bike lane on a 16-block stretch of Broadway between Northwest Hoyt and Southwest Salmon and replace it with a less safe path. Following much community feedback and protest, the Bureau scrapped the plan. Bike Loud Portland, the activist organization, was in the forefront of the campaign, and we salute the good work on this issue and many others. So after pressure and protests, the Bureau of Transportation announced that in the coming year, the Broadway bike lane will be improved and several safety features will be added. Those include new valet loading platforms at three hotels, which PBOT says will reduce conflicts between hotel patrons and bicycle riders. And also, the Bureau will add three signal upgrades at Southwest Oak, Taylor, and Jefferson. The new signals will have separate phrases so that right-turning drivers and bicycle riders will proceed at different times, thus reducing the risk of cyclists being hit by cars. And in another positive Portland story, The Portland City Council voted in support of a $750 million Portland Clean Energy Fund five-year spending plan. At least $80 million of that fund will support bicycling and other transportation programs and projects that encourage people to drive less. $25 million of it will go directly to the Portland Bureau of Transportation to boost an existing program that provides free bus, bike town, scooter, and taxi rides. The plan, funded through taxes on corporations, will include distributing up to 6,000 e-bikes to low-income Portlanders. So two good news to start the day. And our first guest today is a person whose work always brings smiles and encouragement to me. Ms. Karen Frost was the first executive director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, now known as the Street Trust, and was also executive director of the Beaverton-based Westside Transportation Alliance, the WTA. When she retired, the Bike Portland publication described her as, quote, transportation activist and bicycling superhero Karen Frost, who has provided graceful leadership in the Portland metro area for over 20 years. Good day, Karen Frost, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And being a superhero is quite a responsibility. I hope you carry it lightly.
I'm a little embarrassed about that, but I do love it.
It's a testimony to your great work.
Thank you.
So before we get to bicycles, a little bit about your own background. Where are you from? Where did you grow up? And were you always a cyclist?
I grew up in the San Francisco East Bay in San Leandro. I always had a bike, just doodling around the neighborhoods when I was a kid. But then we went every summer to Lake Tahoe. Didn't take a bike because, you know, Highway 89 was not a good ride. But I didn't get really serious about cycling until I was living in Sandpoint, Idaho. I did graphic design then, and I put my little three-month-old baby in the back of the trailer and went out to see, or to do errands, you know, mm-hmm. for supplies and that kind of thing. I never took him to a client meeting. Got hooked on the sensible transport of bicycling at that time.
And was Idaho is not a state I think of usually in connection with cycling. How was it when riding there at the time?
I only rode around town. The streets were not quite as congested as they are now, and I felt pretty safe. I never went on long distance rides at that time. It was really a good exercise for me, and mostly good transport because we had one car and my husband at the time was using that. So it was, I felt very happy to be using my trailer and my child and going around town.
And how then you moved to Portland, I assume, and how did you get involved with bicycle activism?
I wanted to go on a Cycle Oregon. After I came back from that, I decided I did not want to give up bicycling. And although I was working in Tigard at the time, because I was working at in Tigard at the time, I couldn't commute there. I quit my job, got a job downtown. And one of the things that encouraged me, and one of the reasons that we fight for good facilities, is that the bike lanes on Southeast Gladstone told me I should be riding my bike. Mm-hmm. It's safe to ride my bike. So I did that, and I went downtown every day for work. I thought somebody else must be working on this, and that's when I found the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. Mm.
And we're talking now the late 80s, early 90s?
Early 90s.
What was cycling like in Portland at the time? Were there many bike lanes? Were there any parking facilities? What was it like at the time? I know it's 30 years ago, but it sounds like it's ancient history here.
Well, of course, there was a lane on Southeast Gladstone. There was a bike light on coming across on the west side of the Broadway Bridge and not too much else, at least in the way I biked around town. Portland is a city of communities, little neighborhoods, and so it was fairly easy to get around the neighborhoods, and in my area, pretty flat. In that way, Portland had good bones to, you know, increase the number of people bicycling.
At the time, if we're talking about the late 80s, early 90s, when I'd ride my bike and let's say go over the bridge, usually I knew half the people riding, and
yes.
Now I'm glad to say I don't know many of them because there's so many. But at the time, it was, as I recall, a little dangerous, and I participated in some of the early critical mass rides because, unfortunately, there were too many bicycle fatalities at the time.
Yes.
The BTA, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, tell us a little bit about its early days.
It started out as the Portland Bicycle Coalition. And that's because Jim Ferner, an early founder, one of the founders, put up a little poster and set a meeting date. People came and were excited. Two of the people that were there were Rex Burkholder and Matt Giroux. And from there, it grew. Of course, Rex Burkholder was the prime policy person of the BTA. Matt Giroux, a graphic designer, suggested the name Bicycle Transportation Alliance. He was the person who made us look bigger than we were, better than we were, with his graphic design and monthly newsletters. And the numbers grew. We went from, sitting around a living room in chairs to finally getting an office, to moving that office, and gaining more members, more passion, more serious advocacy.
And in those early days, you and Matt Giroux and another activist you mentioned produced public service announcement TV ads titled Decide to Ride, and they're available online. I watched a couple of them. I really enjoyed the sense of humor and playfulness. Tell us a little bit about that campaign. Were they shown on public access TV, or where were they on regular TV?
We partnered with KGW. And my memory is not too good on who came first. I think KGW approached us. And Matt Giroux wrote every video, directed. I got the famous name of producer and then executive producer in type on the, on the credits. And he gave me that title because I was the one going out there and, you know, getting the cast members, getting the props, finding locations. It was great fun. And Matt's a genius.
And if you want a little idea of what those videos were like, you could go to Decide to Ride, and they're available on Vimeo, and I highly recommend them. You are listening to The Bike Show on KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, and our guest today in the first half of the show is longtime bicycle activist Karen Frost, who was the head of the first Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And you described the early days of the organization as a combination of rebel rousers and suits and ties and skirts. Was the variety of members one of the secrets for being effective? And were there ever any tensions between more radical elements, more liberal, or how did that work? How did you resolve things over there?
Well, some of those rabble rousers also wore suits.
and skirts.
And skirts. Well, the thing I put in there, I said about skirts was that we're women, let's wear skirts on our bikes. But there wasn't a great deal of tension. we had members who would call up, or just people, citizens who would call up and say, well, why don't you work on this? Mm-hmm. This is a problem. Why don't you work on this? Well, like any organization, we had a plan. We had a year's plan. We couldn't take on everything. And then some members walked in the door, like Fred Russell, who's now deceased, with a plan. And he managed it. So, you know, that's how we could get, we could go beyond our own plan. We probably were the ones who were out there with the demonstrations and folks saying, oh, maybe we shouldn't move that fast. Not BTA members, but other people saying, maybe you should not move that fast.
And
but
where did the funding in those early days come from?
From membership and from some corporate sponsors. The Bike Gallery was an early sponsor. Jay Graves, when we were just starting out, gave us a monthly donation. It was quite an endorsement of our work.
That's great. So you were with the BTA for 11 years, and what were the organization's greatest accomplishments during that time? And you could be modest.
Oh, where shall I start? Be modest. Well, the first one that folks don't know about, I think, is that our success of getting bikes on the buses. And we were lobbying for the bridges to be improved. So we had, the Hawthorne Bridge was being reconstructed. At that time, it just had wooden pilings up to the river. So it was being reconstructed. We said, this is a good time. Extend the sidewalks. And the county, of course, that owns the bridges, except for the steel bridge, said, well, we'll do a study. So that was an accomplishment, because they did a study, the Willamette River Bridges Accessibility Study, and put in a plan when the bridges could be improved. The city made all of their improvements for the bridges up to the bridge, but then the county had to take it from there. But the most long, widely influenced win was our lawsuit against the city of Portland upholding the bicycle bill that was written in 1971 and largely ignored. We did not win in district court. We won in the Court of Appeals, which was actually better, because in the Court of Appeals then, that meant that every jurisdiction in the state had to make bicycle facilities. And we had a wonderful Representative Michael Ronkin, who was the bicycle and pedestrian program manager at ODOT. So he sent out a directive to all of his employees, or his, you know, the people who worked in transportation for ODOT, saying that they must follow the law. So that was the greatest reach.
And that lawsuit to get the 1971 bicycle bill, which required bike lanes and sidewalks to be built or reconstructed. Why was the city opposed to it? Was it a question of money, or was cycling not viewed as important at the time? Or did some lawyers just need a job, so they had to hire them?
No, I just think it
no
was a
no offense to lawyers. Some of my best friends and my sister's a lawyer.
Yeah. They're good when you need one.
This is a nationwide test of the emergency alert system issued by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, covering the United States from 2:20 to 2:40 p.m. Eastern Time. This is only a test. No action is required by the public.
At And she just said one time, actually, I wasn't at the meeting, just said, well, when they were talking about the bicycle bill, Vera Katz said, well, you sue us. And she believed that when there was discrepancy in following the law, that the courts were the best place to decide that. And so we were a little taken aback, but we went ahead and did it. And we had wonderful volunteer lawyers.
And speaking of politicians or elected officials, who were some of the elected officials that have been most pro-cycling during your tenure at the organization and since? I think of Congressman Blumenauer and the former mayor, Adams, who are both serious cyclists. Are there others you could think of? And how important is it to have political allies in City Hall? Or
Well, I love the Earl Blumenauer getting lots of credit. He actually came to one of our early board meetings when we were thinking about suing the city and asked us not to. So he was not wearing his little bicycle pin then.
Or his bow tie.
Perhaps he had a bow tie. I don't remember that. But he is a wonderful advocate. From then on, now, you see pictures of Earl. He always has his bicycle pin on. I wasn't with the BTA when Sam Adams was mayor, but, you know, kept in touch with things that he was doing, but I can't name any special successes. But Charlie Hales, when he was city commissioner of transportation, I just saw Charlie a couple weeks ago. And we were reminiscing about bicycling, and I brought up the subject of the bike lanes on Southeast 7th and how wonderful it was that, you know, the city just did them. And Mia Burke was the one who, you know, I suppose convinced Charlie, let's just do it. There wasn't any, you know, outreach or anything like that. They just saw the traffic counts, decided it would run, be better flow of traffic and good for cyclists. So sort of like in the dead of the night, they they striped those lanes, and Charlie Hales was, you know, an advocate of that.
And I think now a lot of politicians, it seems to me, they use the right words about cycling, but they don't always follow through. So I'm always impressed by elected officials that do, like the ones we mentioned. Our time is just zooming by here, but and I still have so many questions, but you know, when I think of the BTA and any cycling organization, you know, I think also about the cultural, the sort of creating a community besides the advocacy, besides the political. And you help inaugurate two wonderful projects, at least two wonderful ones, Bike Commute Challenge and also the Alice B. Toe Clips Award. So tell our listeners, please, about those.
Well, it was time for us to attract more attention. And having events was one way to do it. The I'm going to start first with Alice B. Toe Clips Award. To set everybody straight, the name Alice B. Toe Clips did not come from the wonderful cyclist in San Francisco, Jackie Phelan was her name. Could have been could have been Psychic Unity. But she calls herself Alice B. Toe Clips. A board member and I were sitting in having coffee, trying to come up with a name, and we were naming all the parts of the bike, because one of the events for the Bike Commute Challenge was a bicycle hubbub. Bicycle hub. So we came to Toe Clips, and that was it. I had just been reading about, you know, Gertrude Stein, and that was the name. For the Bike Commute Challenge, we were interested in employers being influenced through their employees' passion for cycling. And yeah, I'm very proud of those. My one of my strengths with the BTA was this public outreach. even though I had the title of executive director, I wasn't a strong policy person. And my love was, you know, in encouragement and getting more members.
And Alice B. Toklip, if you look at their website of the Street Trust, wonderful, well-deserving individuals. Of all different backgrounds,
yes.
Interests, different contributions.
May I add, that's a stark contrast. When we first started, we were all pretty white. And we did not reach out. We made a few attempts to other organizations, but I really admire the Street Trust for their diversity. And it came to that point where they wanted to change from just a bicycling focus to more transport, and the Street Trust did that with a great number of other organizations and strong people.
We have time, unfortunately, only for about two more questions, but how do we, this might be a big one, but you know, Portland has made many strides as far as cycling and increasing the number of cyclists and making it safer, but we're still kind of stuck at about 7%, and we have this wonderful bike plan that envisioned that by 2030, at least 25% of the rides will be by bike. How do we get there? And you have about 2 minutes, so not a...
Well, we're a victim of COVID.
Uh-huh.
And many people, many employees not coming downtown.
Mm.
Portland is suffering from employees not coming downtown. So I think that's one of it. But another is just pushing advocacy. The Bike Loud came up, and they are like the young BTA,
mm-hmm.
passionate about one topic. And all transportation, but still the focus is gathering passionate people about bicycling.
Mm-hmm.
And they were out there with the, Southwest Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And another congratulations mm-hmm. goes to Jonathan Moss mm-hmm. of Bike Portland,
who's done wonderful work over the years. So mm-hmm. We applaud both of them. Well, and finally, what's next for you personally? Where might we find you in 5-10 years?
Well,
would you be still riding a bike?
Oh yeah. I haven't owned a car for 23 years, so I'll still be riding my bike. I may have to not be able to lift it up so high onto the bike rack, but I will continue to ride my bike. I'm going to Europe next year. Summer and doing some riding and bicycling there. I signed up to be a plaintiff for Bike Loud's suit because they needed standing in their second go round with mm-hmm. their suit. So nothing much is, I haven't been required to do anything there, and I intend to get a little more involved with Bike Loud.
Amen. you are listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KABU studio in Portland, Oregon, on 90.7 FM and streaming on KABU.FM. We have been speaking with Karen Frost, the first executive director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, currently known as the Street Trust, and an individual who played and still plays an important role in helping make Portland a good cycling town. So thank you, Karen Frost, for sharing your knowledge, your insight, your love of cycling, and much success with your work and with riding.
Thank you. I appreciate being invited.
And I think we'll take a short musical break. And in the second half of the hour, co-host Nedra Deadweiler will speak with Atlanta urban geographer Neil Davis. Mr. Davis's work strives to understand, as he writes on his website, and I quote, urban tensions existing at the intersection of education, transportation, planning and sustainability, and evaluate how these factors impact inclusive development and economic resilience in underserved communities. So stay tuned. You are listening to The Bike Show.
It takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. You can take a ride up in Forest Park. You can ride with the light if you ride in the dark. You can ride from the mountain down to the beach. You can ride on a trail. You can ride in the street. You can ride through a puddle. You can ride in the rain. You can take it on a bus. You can take it on a train. Take a ride through the waterfront or down from the zoo.
And my name is Alon Robb, and in the second half of the show, co-host Nedred Deadweiler will interview Atlanta-based urban geographer Neil Davis. So, Nedra, take it away.
Thanks, Alon. That was a nice interview with you and Karen Frost. And Karen, thank you so much for your transformative work in Portland. Neil, I'm excited to have you on today. To have you talk about your research and the work that you do with young people to get them on bicycles. Neil Davis is an urban geographer who investigates the intersection of equity and government policies to create systemic change. Welcome to the show, Neil.
Hi there, Nedra. Thank you for having me. Thank you as well, Alon.
So, just to kind of set the framework, what does it mean to be an urban geographer, and how did you get started on this path?
Okay, well, what I'll do is I'll kind of flip that question around a little bit. Ironically, the reason that I even ended up on this path is because of something transportation related. When I worked at the airport roughly about 10 years ago, I was actually part of the risk management team, and I got hit by a vehicle at work. And from then on, you know, it literally nudged me in this direction. I decided to go back to school, and I went back for public policy. And a lot of this became a big focus to me unknowingly. And so moving along, as I went back into school and completed graduate work, it was an interdisciplinary studies on the urban policy side. And so urban geography is really the study of cities and the urban processes that happen within those cities. And you really take into consideration what urban life means and really what the built environment means as a result of all of these processes and your study of the city.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. I'm wondering, with your focus on urbanism and communities, the built environment and its development, some of your work also looks at the school system. And so because now you do a lot of work within the cycling community here in Atlanta, I am wondering if you rode a bike as a young person, and if you'll share some of the meaningful experiences you had while riding a bike. And if that included being in an urban environment, what kind of a place did you grow up in?
So that is actually a really funny question for me, because I remember as a kid, I had a bike. It was this orange bike called the Crazy Cat. And I have no idea what happened to that bike, but I loved it. And I had that bike probably just before I was 10 or so. And then there was a little gap between the time that I actually had a bike and was riding. But then I grew up in San Antonio, Texas. And so there were always a group of kids riding around and whatnot. And it's funny because I've had a couple of conversations with friends recently, and I was like, you know, which kid were you? Were you the one that could change the chains out real fast, or were you the tire person? And honestly, I think I was the tire guy in the neighborhood. I was always able to flip those out. But even from then on, it kind of died down. San Antonio is definitely where we lived anyway. It definitely has a more suburban feel now. So literally we were riding around, you know, just on the streets that were immediately adjacent to my own. But you know, I didn't get to move around the city the way that I do now. And so I think a lot of that starts to shape how it is that I think about cities, you know, just thinking about, you know, there are parts of cities that do have more urban feels. You know, there's a lot more movement going on versus certain spaces that just feel very, very suburban, and you're kind of isolated at times. So, yeah, a lot of that has shaped where I am now.
Yeah, I'm thinking about comparing Atlanta to Portland. They're both are cities that are a city of neighborhoods and kind of have that similar suburban / urban, depending on where you are, feel to it. And I know on your website you have aerial footage, and you also post a lot on Twitter showing, talking about connectivity, discussing the built environment. When you're showing that footage, can you explain how, where the education, public health, transportation policy, the area, the interdisciplinary focus of your work, how that comes together in some of the footage that you show?
Most definitely. So a lot of times when I am, when I'm moving around, I have a 12-year-old now. Actually, my son will be 13 on Monday. And so a lot of that is informed by how it is that I consider his movement around the city, you know, with or without me. I think that we're definitely smart enough people, and we're definitely people that should be reasonable enough to be able to keep things simple. And typically when I'm making posts, you know, if I'm out, and I spend a lot of time on my bike, not just in my neighborhood, but I move around all the neighborhoods. And so I really want to spark conversation about the things that actually make sense in cities and the things that don't make sense, and try to compel people to think about, hey, why isn't it that we haven't made a change in one direction or another? Because, you know, really using my son as that central focus, because his school is really close. We live just over a mile away from his school, and there are certain spaces that are just extremely hectic, and they don't have to be. And so how is it that I think a lot of the questions in those photos that I post are really about, why are we allowing this to happen? You know, do we not care about these people? Shouldn't we want people to be as safe as they can be within these spaces? So I'm really trying to spark a conversation. I know which direction that I lean in, but you know, ultimately these are things that I want for everybody. You know, it's not just about my son, it's about all the kids that go to his school, you know, all 1200 of them. It's about, you know, the seniors within your community. It's about people with, you know, different levels of physical ability, you know, whether they're in a wheelchair or not. So I think this is where, you know, all of that intersectionality starts to have some play. You know, everyone should be able to get out and move and take care of themselves in a healthy manner. You know, it doesn't have to necessarily be by bike. A lot of the kids now, you know, when you look at the school, there's a kid that locks his skateboard up to the bike racks because that's how he gets to school. Some kids ride bikes. Others, you know, may roller skate. You know, I think it's a lot of those photos are questioning, is it safe for this person to move, you know, on a scooter in this space? You know, why not? Well, we have plenty of space, you know. I think one of the other big, big things that I have too is, you know, every space isn't built for a car. And I think people need to be comfortable with that. You know, some streets are just too narrow. Sometimes there's too much, you know, pedestrian traffic. Sometimes there's just too much going on. So a lot of that goes into a lot of those photos and those thoughts that I post.
I think that's an excellent point, that every space is not built for a car. I feel like that needs to be on a T-shirt everywhere and posted on a billboard sign across the country. I am wondering, with that being said, high pedestrian traffic, I mean, I can think of an intersection, like several intersections here. I mean, now there's diagonal crossing, which is helpful to get a lot of people across the street, different directions, during the pause at the light. But what conversations have you had with people, and how did it go when you say that, like, every space is not built for a car? And what are some of the responses that you get?
Honestly, I don't have those conversations with the people while I'm out on my bike or while I'm walking, with them being in the vehicle, because I think that just I think that tends to polarize the conversation a little bit more. But, you know, typically when I'm just out or having conversation with people about it, by and large, most people would tend to agree, you know, especially when you're pointing out those spaces. You know, we have some really, really new space along the Beltline here that is between my home and my son's school. And, you know, they've proposed to have a light rail going through here. It's a heavily pedestrian traffic area. Cyclists and scooters have a heavy presence there as well. And this is one of those spaces, and I've not met one person that has said, you know, cars just absolutely belong here, you know. And I think as you start to see the congestion, when you get people out of the car, because so many of them just, you see how much anxiety they have when they're there, you know, it changes the conversation when you have them away from the vehicle, you know. And it's not, I don't hate cars. I have a car myself, but I'm getting pretty allergic to it whenever I have the opportunity to, you know. I'll be on my bike or walking in a heartbeat. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for that response. I'm going to make a station announcement. You are listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO studio in Portland, Oregon, on 90.7 FM, streaming on KBOO FM, and also available as a podcast at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The show is co-hosted by Alon Robb and Nedra Deadweiler, and engineered by Ty Walker. And we are here talking with Neil Davis, an urban geographer and bicycle advocate for young people. So just to turn the conversation a little bit to some of the research that you have done around equity and government policies to change systemic barriers. Some of your work has been looking at educational centers, and will you talk a little bit about that research?
Sure, I will. So my latest research, this was for my capstone at school, was looking at whether or not the Atlanta Public School System's transportation policy was supportive of middle and high school students that travel between home and school. And part of the reason that I did that is because, you know, one, my son is actually making this trip, and I'm, you know, as a parent, I'm trying to make sure that he's as safe as possible, and I'm not, you know, giving him too much leeway to where, you know, there are certain situations that the children just aren't equipped to handle. And I began looking at the transportation policy, and it you know, it says if your student lives within 1 to 1.5 miles of distance of school, then they have to travel by themselves. And as I said a little bit earlier, there are a couple of intersections that are extremely highly trafficked, and I question, you know, whether or not we have the proper safety, you know, safety measures in place, or safety options anyway, for these kids to make this trip by themselves. You know, a middle and high school age student is quite different from a college student, and we should, you know, treat them with some care as well. There are a couple of paths that have paint, but, you know, paint is just an additional space for a car to park illegally, or, you know, just to take up to cut around somebody to get through a light faster. And so when we're putting children in positions like that, you know, yeah, 1 to 1.5 miles away from school isn't, it, honestly, it's not that far, but you really have to take into consideration the conditions that they're in. So when I looked at this policy and looked at what our trip looked like, I decided that I wanted to compare what our school cluster has compared to a school cluster that is on the southwest side of town. And the findings were really interesting, partially because, you know, on our, in our cluster that's on the eastern side of town, we have a lot more transportation facilities accessible to our children versus what they have on the southwest side. We have the Atlanta Beltline. We have you know, paints that are supposed to indicate infrastructure and whatnot. But when you get to the southwest side of town, the Beltline doesn't touch that school district at all. And then additionally, that school district is located on what we call the high injury network, and we have a couple of those in Atlanta, and they have a lot of transportation incidents with pedestrians and cyclists and whatnot. So that was the beginning of my work, you know, looking at, you know, how safe is it for children, but then also from an equity standpoint, looking at whether or not we're providing the kids throughout the city with the same options and the same functions of safety throughout.
So those are interesting findings, in the fact that there is, in the southwest part of Atlanta, high injury network is what those streets are considered, because they are 2 4-lane, 4 or 5 really wide highway roads that go through neighborhoods, state routes that go through neighborhoods, and people go, you know, top 60 miles per hour. So we're thinking about young people, middle school, high school, traveling by themselves, without a bus, so walking or biking or some other mode of transportation to school. To me, that sounds dangerous. Because kids don't always pay attention when they're in public space. I'm wondering if you have through your analysis you've done, development for the differential in environment, or some recommendations for increasing safety. And, you know, for schools or for the school system, for specific schools, or for the school system at large?
Definitely. So, and just kind of dropping back to some more of what the research had leading into this, leading into like the recommendations and whatnot. What I did is I looked at data from, for a 5-year period from 2015 to 2020. And I found that there were 3,278 traffic incidents with people that weren't in vehicles. You know, they were either pedestrians. There were actually 2,892 pedestrians that were cited, and then 386 bicycle incidents. And, you know, over a 5-year period, it was kind of alarming, especially when you put it on the map, because you see those high areas of population of where it is happening over and over and over again. And so When I started taking that into consideration, I also started looking at what the built environment looked like. You know, on that southwest side of town, that is where it definitely has the more suburban feel. There are a lot more longer and wider streets, as you pointed out, associated with the high injury networks, versus, you know, being here on the east side of town where things are a little bit more compact. There are actually, you know, lines that delineate where certain people are supposed to have space, and then there are also paths that are safer for the children to be in. But when I started looking at that, you know, one of the biggest suggestions was, hey, we need to start, you know, equally providing these children on the southwest side with the same, you know, infrastructure as what we have on the east side of town. Because, I mean, there's a stark difference, you know. In addition to that, sidewalks, the state of the sidewalks on that side of town are really, really poor. But again, they're abutting, you know, these areas of really high rates of traffic. So that became one thing. I also wanted to look at, you know, starting out with the school streets program, because I've noticed that a lot of that it's starting to build momentum, and there are places that are making it work of comparable size to our schools that I use to compare, you know. And I think this would be a great way to get children familiar with taking another form of transportation other than a car, and actually pushing those vehicles away from the schools. You know, with school streets, you're able to shut down the streets around the school for, you know, between 20 and 90 minutes, whatever. That was one of my big proposals was, hey, let's give these children a safe way to get to school, you know, without having that burden of all of those vehicles. And then also another, you know, back in line with the infrastructure, one of the best examples of what we have here in Atlanta is there's a path on the backside of Georgia Tech, and the path is 1.5 miles. And, you know, one of my interventions is, hey, why don't we go ahead and, you know, within the public schools transportation budget, start building out a mile and a half, at least a mile and a half. You know, I think my recommendation was 2 miles, because I'm like, hey, go ahead and ask for what you want and shoot a little bit longer than what everybody else is. But, you know, if we started extending each year, you know, instead of doing nothing, you know, instead of throwing these large sums of money in for buses, because they spend roughly $32 million a year as of like 2020, I believe, on buses here. And it's like, hey, if we would put in just a little bit, carve in a little bit for the middle and high schools to have protected infrastructure around the school, that would make a huge, huge difference. And do it incrementally, you know, do it every year, go in and say, hey, we have a goal of adding, you know, maybe 4 miles to around each school. And that would be a huge, huge difference in terms of building out the citywide network at that point, because schools are, you know, the central point. They represent, you know, a place in the neighborhood that kids go to every day. You know, they generally pass by libraries and grocery stores and parks and things like that. So I think it would make a huge difference in providing for a comprehensive network that really makes meaningful connections for people.
Thank you. I appreciate you pointing out the importance of schools as community centers. There are not a lot of centers in communities anymore, but people still continue to go to school. Young people are still go to school, elementary through high school. So by seeing that and creating as an infrastructure, that's a real ingenious idea. I also appreciate your optimism. So, and with that, we have a few more minutes left, so maybe two more questions. You are a researcher, but you're not only a researcher, you're also a community builder, and you've done a lot of work with young people and the school community. Can you talk a little bit about that work?
Definitely. So part of one of my classes was related to doing, you know, community service, and I was recommended to go to a school that I ended up finding out only had one bus going to that school to do my work. And I ended up deciding to do a bike parade there. You know, I was thinking, if they only have one bus here, this means, you know, all of these kids are literally being driven to school, when a more healthy and more sustainable way of doing it would be for, you know, them to either ride in or walk in with their parents. And so I did the bike parade in order to get them familiar with it, because the other thing about it is I use the bike parade, you know, on one hand it is to help promote sustainability, but it also teaches them a spatial awareness. You know, once you start actually moving around independently, you start seeing how close you are to things. And I wanted to use it as a way to help them value their space. You know, I think a lot of times, especially these days, I see a lot of kids when I go and pick up my son, you know, they're just standing outside and they text their parents and they stand there. Whereas I look at my son and a couple of his friends and, you know, they hop on their bikes and they go. And I want that freedom of safety and movement and that sense of independence that they'll begin building just from, you know, being comfortable with getting on a bike. And so that was really the premise of me doing that, you know, and them understanding, hey, sometimes I can get there faster by using a bike or using a scooter or something because of my proximity to whatever that final destination is. So I really, that was the purpose of it. And ironically, my son became unhappy with me because I did the bike parade at another school. So I ended up doing one at his, you know, and again, it was one of those situations where you have people that do have slightly better infrastructure, facilities, and whatnot. But it's still making sure that we're giving everybody the same information, trying to coach them up the same way and give them an option of another way to do things is really important to me. It's really, really important to me.
Yeah, I love that introducing young people to like the things in their community, especially by bike. That the fact that you're just giving them new skills, helping with that confidence that can be really fragile at those ages, and also realize that they can do something different from their parents, right? Like, and if they're riding, you're getting their parents on bikes too. So, and just one more question, Neil, what's next for you? What's on deck? How do we get in touch with you or stay connected?
Honestly, the next thing for me will be the next bike ride. But seriously, I intend to keep doing this because, you know, this is when I initially took on my capstone project, I don't know that I really thought about how far it could reach, but I immediately started thinking of home, and thinking about how it would help reshape where I grew up, because it does feel very, very suburban now. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but typically with that suburban experience, you know, you come out of a neighborhood and you're in a pretty hostile transportation situation, especially in San Antonio. You know, there are a lot of people that drive trucks, you know, it definitely more so than here in Atlanta. And so trying to give the people an option, another option to being in that vehicle. You know, you interact with the world so differently. You see distances so differently. And so I think really my plan is to continue doing projects like this and finding more people that are interested in moving and trying to support them and getting what it is that they're looking for in their area as well, because what fits for me doesn't necessarily fit for them. So I'll just continue to do that. And typically, if anyone wanted to reach me, I'm on LinkedIn. I believe my handle is Neil Davis, M-I-S. And then also I have a site posted at Card, and it's Neil with two L's, N-E-I-L-L-O Davis, .card, that's C-A-R-R-D.co. And definitely, they can give me a call as well. I believe my phone number is posted on the Card website as well.
Thanks so much for joining us today here on KBOO Radio. I appreciate your optimism, Neil. Keep up the work and see you on two wheels. Back to you, Alon.
You have been listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO studio in Portland, Oregon. And my name is Alon Robb. I would like to thank our guests, Karen Frost and Neil Davis, for being on the show and your good work in the world. And Neil Davis, you mentioned your kid's birthday coming up. So happy birthday to your kid. May his new year be a good one. And I'd like to also thank my co-host, Nedra Deadweiler. It's always a pleasure and an honor to co-host with you, Nedra. Our engineer, Ty Walker, always doing a wonderful job here. Thank you, Ty. And also Chris Smith and Josh Hetrick. And as always, a big thank you to you, our listeners. We appreciate your support.